This morning, in the first session, I'm going to talk about my dad, and I'm going to talk about Darren Wilson and Michael Brown, and I'm going to talk about James Cone and his essay entitled Theology's Great Sin, Silence in the Face of White Supremacy. Then we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to talk about what I think are the two foundations upon which I build my understandings of white privilege. That would be the notion of whiteness as the norm and whiteness as cash value. I love the title to a book by George Lipsitz, a white sociologist who studied this dynamic. And the title of his book is The Possessive Investment in Whiteness. That's a great title. The Possessive Investment in Whiteness. I'll try to leave time in both sessions for some questions or comments that you might have. So I'm going to start by talking a little bit about my relationship with my father. And to set that up, I need you to take you back to 2003, when I entered the white privilege studies as a doctoral student at United Theological Seminary in Dayton, Ohio. There were probably about 70 doctoral students entering the program, but there were two white men who were there to study white privilege and its effect on the church. So it was a very narrow focus. Like all of the doctoral students, we had to submit an application, and the application included what they called a spiritual autobiography. I had written this before, so that was not a difficult assignment for me, and I submitted it and was received as a student in the doctoral programs there, showed up on campus, began studies under the Reverend Dr. Sam Mann. This is a gentleman that I had come to know as my spiritual father. And the first thing he told the two white men who were entering these studies is, you need to rewrite your spiritual autobiography, this time through the lens of race. I thought, okay. Now, I'm a white man. Nobody had ever asked me to tell my story through the lens of race. And we'll deal more with this in the second session when we talk about whiteness as the norm. Whites don't see themselves as racialized people. We're essentially people without race in our world, and everybody else who's seen as different in skin tone are the people who are racial or ethnic. One of the things we often say is, do you have any ethnic people? Well, we have an ethnicity as whites. We just are so enculturated to see ourselves as the norm that we don't think that way. I literally could not do the assignment. I mean, I did it, but it was done so poorly and awkwardly that it was clear I had no idea what he was asking. I took my spiritual autobiography as I had written it back home and realized, oh, I didn't put in any people of color in my story. That's what he's asking me to do. So I had to go back through my life and, oh yeah, Mr. Lee, my seventh grade homeroom teacher, was a black man. I should probably tell a story or two about him. And Fred Rogers was my only black classmate growing up. I should write a story about him, and all of a sudden I had a spiritual autobiography told through the lens of race. Job well done. And I handed it in, and he said, this is garbage. Now, again, this is the man I call my spiritual father. I had clearly disappointed him, and I took it back and wrote it again, handed it back in, and it was garbage a second time, actually now a third time. And one of the things he pointed out to me this time was, how come every time you introduce a character of color in your story, you identify their race? But with the white characters in your story, there's nothing identifying them. I said, what are you talking about? He says, well, for example, your dad, what color is he? I thought, that's a dumb question. He's white, Sam, and you know that. Well, then why didn't you put my white father? And so I went home, and every time a white character appeared, I wrote white, and it felt awkward. My white dad, my white teacher, my white homiletics professor, all of the people who had impacted my spirit growing up in the telling of a spiritual autobiography. And that simple act of putting white in front of the name, I mechanically could perform that task, but it felt awkward. And now, without me even realizing it, I was getting my first lesson in white privilege. It is a privilege to live in a world where you can identify everybody else without thinking about it with a racial qualifier except you and your people. And it was my first lesson of what it means to walk in a different world as a white man than anybody and everybody else. But I was still trying to understand. I rewrote it, and I was getting closer. I had to write this paper 5 times. And it didn't occur to me what I was being asked to do until this line got written as the opening line to my spiritual autobiography Through the Lens of Race. And the opening line read, "My father was a bigot, and I hated my father. Now I could tell my story." And even, I've said this line 1,000 times, the emotion still surfaces so quickly. And here's what dawned on me. My spiritual health was affected by inheriting a legacy through my father and his father and his father before him of this system of racial injustice that afforded me to walk differently in a world without giving me the awareness of walking in that world. And what happened when that line got written and the story that would follow was the beginning of a spiritual healing of a spiritual wound that until those moments was unrecognized. And I'm here to tell you that this work of dismantling privilege is not about white people doing good things to black people. It's about healing a spiritual wound that white people have been carrying for centuries. And it's incredibly important work. That it may also contribute to the creation of a system and a culture of racial equity is also a very good thing. But this is work that white people need to do to heal themselves. And I'm proud to say that this work of dealing with this wound and healing it, some of the most important work I do. And I understand that one of the things that I'm committed to is the unfolding of a story through a lifetime that opens up the possibility that my children and their children, when they tell their spiritual autobiography through the lens of race, don't have to begin it with a statement like, "My father was a racist and I hated my father." I want them to be able to tell a different story. Once that line opened up, the real story of my spiritual unfolding revealed itself in moments like these. I'm 10 years old. I'm sitting on the couch in the living room with my father. It's a Sunday afternoon in the fall, and our beloved St. Louis football Cardinals are playing on television. They were known as the Cardiac Cardinals at the time because they had a propensity for waiting until the closing seconds of the game to determine the outcome, and this game would be no different. We're down 5 points. We're driving in the closing seconds. There's enough time for one more play to be run. It has to be a touchdown or we lose. The ball gets snapped to the white quarterback, Jim Hart, who drops back, sees an opening in the end zone and throws the ball to the black running back, Terry Metcalf. And there the ball lands in his hands, and we're about ready to jump off the couch in excitement, and the ball slips through his hands and falls to the ground. Cardinals lose. I'm heartbroken. My white father, knowing that it's his responsibility to pass on the legacy of what it means to be white and what it means to be black to his seven children, turns to me on the couch and says, in what he interprets to be a teachable moment, "John, never throw to a black man in the clutch. They're great athletes, but they don't know how to think." Only he didn't use the word black. Now, I'm 10 years old. I have no idea what a 10-year-old son is supposed to think about their father in such moments. But I was disgusted. This is a man I looked up to, loved and admired. And it was in moments like that that this hatred of who my father was and had become began to emerge. And boy, by the time I grew into my young adult years, my father and I had very little to agree about and very little to do with each other. I'm happy to tell you that long before the time he died, we had worked things out. But the pain during those years was real. My uncle, that white father's brother, a Roman Catholic priest and another hero of mine, I'm about the same age, we're driving down the streets of St. Louis, where I grew up, and car comes from around through an intersection, and my uncle slams on his brakes just in time to avoid what would have been a nasty collision. And I'm sitting in the car next to him, and we both look at the driver whom we almost hit with this frightened look on her face. And my uncle now realizes this is his moment to teach his white nephew what it means to be white and what it means to be black, and also what it means to be male. This is what he says, "John, women drivers are bad. Black drivers are worse, but the worst of all is a black woman." Now, in the unfolding of a spiritual autobiography told through the lens of race, it didn't occur to me the first, the second, the third, or the fourth time that these are the stories I was being asked to unpack. The Reverend Dr. Sam Mann was a white man who grew up in Eufaula, Alabama, who had the same relationship with his white racist father. He was ordained by a renegade bishop who laid hands on him in the basement of a church in Kansas City because Sam's position as a white man in the mid-1960s on both the civil rights and Vietnam rendered him, in the eyes of the establishment, unordainable. But this renegade bishop knew that this was a prophet and that the voice of this man would end up changing the world. So, with no permission, he took him into the basement of a church and laid hands on him, but no church would hire him. So Sam found himself as a young man and a father with three kids walking the streets of Kansas City and ministering to gang members and drug addicts and eking out whatever existence he could. And then a church lost its pastor. It was an inner city black congregation. And Sam had built up a bit of a reputation for working with the hardcore marginalized people on the streets. And they hired him as their interim pastor, and he stayed there for about 40 years. And I used to go worship with Sam to have my spiritual wounds healed long before I knew how to say those words out loud. And this is what I learned about that church and the way they worshiped. It was an entirely black inner city congregation. And they began to get in touch with their African spiritual roots. And every worship service would begin with the steady beat of a drum. And as that drum would beat, Sam would turn to Mother Meriwether, the oldest woman in the church, and ask permission to speak. And then they would call upon the ancestors and their spirits to be present in that space. And you would begin to look around the altar and the sanctuary. It was in the round, the altar was in the middle. And every place you looked had just artifacts of those who had gone before them, their spiritual ancestors. And they were, you could feel the presence of those spirits in the room. And there was a healing that was going on there, not just for the occupants or the worshipers who, feeling the presence and calling upon the memories of their ancestors, felt some spiritual healing. They were also aware that there were wounds that these ancestors took with them that in that space and in that moment needed healing. It was in gathering in that space that I became intuitively, certainly not cognitively, but intuitively aware of the residual power of our ancestors and how their stories, becoming our stories, impact our spiritual health and wholeness. And all of this is to say that the work of doing that spiritual autobiography and figuring out what was being asked of me was not only a pathway to my own spiritual wholeness, it was an invitation for the ancestors of my family to come and gather in the same spiritual space and be healed as well. This is incredibly powerful work we're talking about doing here. And I begin any conversation I have about privilege with this story for two reasons. One is, I think the most impactful way to engage in this conversation, especially as white people dealing with their privilege, is not to begin asking yourself, how racist am I, and in what ways am I still racist? But to begin to go back through your life and the life of your ancestors and rehearse the stories of how it was you came to learn what it means to be white, what it means to be black, what it means to be a person of color. Who taught you that? And how did you feel when those lessons were taught to you? I invite you, as you enter into this conversation, to find a way to capture your story, whether it's sitting down with somebody you love and trust and telling them your story, whether it's journaling. Find a way to begin to rehearse those stories as a process of entering this in order to heal your own deep spiritual wounds, and as a way of opening up your life to new possibilities on the other side of that. Now, I'm going to transition because there's a second reason I begin that way. Understanding my father's story and his understanding of what it meant to be a white father, carrying on the responsibility of passing on understandings of what it means to be white and black to his seven children, is a way of understanding what happened to Michael Brown and Darren Wilson on the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, almost 2 years ago. I grew up less than 5 miles from the place where Michael Brown was shot. And I don't know Darren Wilson personally, but I do know what it is to grow up white on the streets of St. Louis and have a white father who's teaching his son what it means to be white. And when you put yourself in Darren Wilson's shoes on that hot August afternoon, you have to back up for a moment and ask, what was Darren Wilson, other than his gun, carrying with him on the streets of Ferguson? Now, as a white man, as a white police officer, driving through a predominantly black neighborhood. What was he carrying with him? And I have a deep and profound respect for our officers of the law who put themselves in harm's way in order to protect citizens every day, and who in a moment's notice have to assess the level of danger that they're encountering, and in those moments needing to assess how much they need to fear for their lives, but through the eyes of a cop, how much they have to fear for the lives that they are sworn to protect. And knowing what it was like as a white child growing up in St. Louis, it's not hard for me to imagine that Darren Wilson was taught the same things about what it means to be white and black as I was taught. It's a part of the St. Louis culture. St. Louis is still one of the most racially divided cities in the country. And at some point in that encounter with Michael Brown, I have no doubt that Darren Wilson was scared. But I have no doubt that if he were five blocks to the west in Ladue, Missouri, one of the whitest and wealthiest neighborhoods, and somebody was walking down the street off of the curb, A, he would have never stopped his car. B, he would have never said to that white person, "I think you should be on the sidewalk." But even if he did those two things, there would have never been a moment in whatever exchange followed that he would have felt afraid. And the only difference that needed to be present was that that person was white. You take the same set of circumstances with that white cop and put him in a black neighborhood, where already, as he's driving down the street, he's on high alert because of assumptions he's making. I have no doubt that his father did the same thing when he was a child that my father did driving down those streets. He would turn and either reach back into the car and lock our doors, or say to us as he was driving, "Lock your doors." And so already built into the equation was a hermeneutic of suspicion and an assumption of fear. Fear was already there before he encountered Michael Brown walking down the street. My parents never had to have the talk with me about what to do if you're pulled over by a police officer. And I've been pulled over by police officers. And I never thought twice about defending my rights when I thought the police officer was out of line. And I have never once in my life in such moments felt fear or threatened by the exchange. When Michael Brown, a proud young man, realizing that he was not being treated fairly, was anything but completely compliant, but actually spoke up for himself, Darren Wilson's fear factor went up tenfold. And at some point, the context of fear that was already implanted within him led him to believe that now he had to fear for his life. This is the nature of privilege. And if you're white, you carry it with you everywhere you go. Another exercise, and we'll talk a little bit more about this in the next session when we get to whiteness as the norm, that John Paddock, the other white student, and I did, is we started literally asking ourselves every day, what do you see? When I taught the course on white privilege at Eden Seminary, every day I would say to the students, the last thing they would hear from me is go home and see, and when we come back tomorrow, tell me what you see. I think this is the most important work that white people of privilege can undertake. Privilege is there and it's made manifest every day of our lives and we don't see it. So the question is, what do you see? So this is what we started doing mechanically in order to see what was there to be seen. We'd be driving down the street, pull into a gas station, walk into the convenience store, grab a soda or a candy bar, and the young woman working the counter would look up at us and smile, thank us for coming in, and tell us to have a nice day. And we'd walk out and say to ourselves, she said that because I'm white. May or may not be true. It probably was. But it was a moment to step back and say, privilege just manifested itself. We'd be driving down the road and see a police officer pull somebody over, look at my speedometer, I'm going 8 miles an hour over the limit. I'd say, I didn't get pulled over because I'm white. I'd walk into a grocery store and I would see all of the food that I and my white culture are accustomed to eating, and I'd say, this grocery store owner provides for me everyday food that he knows I like because I'm white. I'd walk into a barber shop and there'd be somebody there and I wouldn't have to tell them how to cut my hair, and I'd walk out and have this nice cut, and I'd say, if I weren't white, I couldn't have walked in with the assumptions. I mean, this is how we started playing the game. And I think it's important for those of us who grow up white to begin at least acknowledging every day what happens to us as a result of our privilege. I'm going to transition here and talk about one of my heroes growing up. Actually, not growing up. It wasn't until I got into college that I discovered the writings of James Cone. First book I read of his was For My People, and it just transformed me. It gave me language to talk about how to process all of the stuff that I was dealing with around race. And then when we were doing the doctoral work, we actually got to travel down to Birmingham, Alabama, and listen to him deliver this presentation. It's an essay that's now been published entitled Theology's Great Sin, Silence in the Face of White Supremacy. While he was delivering the speech, he gave two quotes to set his presentation up. The first was a lengthy quote from Martin Luther King that I don't remember word for word, and I won't repeat it to you for that reason. The second one was a very short quote, and it was one I'll never forget. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the quote is, when God calls you, God bids you come and die. Which is a way of saying that the gospel will ask things of you and will test your commitment to the gospel against your desire to be comfortable. Preachers have to wrestle with this all the time. They'll feel God place upon them a word to speak that they know will be a disquieting and discomforting word. And they have to wrestle with, is this the right time? Is this the right place? What will be the cause and effect of preaching such a word? I listened to Jill through the weekend talk about getting arrested. And I mean, there are moments when those of privilege are asked to sacrifice some of their privilege and have to calculate. This is the quandary, every time a white person hears another white person tell a race joke, they know they shouldn't laugh. They know they should say something. But 9 times out of 10, they just sort of seethe quietly and don't say something. It was in that context, Theology's Great Sin, Silence in the Face of White Supremacy, that James Cone quotes Dietrich Bonhoeffer, when God calls you, God bids you come and die. And though the right thing may be costly at times, and nobody knows this more than Dietrich, who literally gave his life in an effort to free Jews who were being annihilated in a genocide perpetrated by his government. He was sitting in New York with Reinhold Niebuhr, with a wonderful Manhattan apartment and a cushy teaching job. And he felt the call to go back and be a liberator. And Reinhold Niebuhr did his best to talk him out of it. But when God calls you, God bids you come and die. And sometimes the cause of justice is more important than your safety, your security, or your comfort. That's how James Cone began his presentation. And it convicted me. And it reminded me that as a man of privilege, I could and should be doing so much more. James Cone went on in the essay to talk about the four reasons why white religious leaders of privilege remain silent in the face of white power, white privilege, and white supremacy. And I'm going to rehearse for you those four reasons. He's spot on with every one of them. The first, and probably the most important, reason why white leaders remain silent and do not speak is because they don't have to. We're going to rehearse later this morning in the presentation on whiteness as cash value, the state and condition of whiteness in America as we know it today. And what James Cone points out is, if white children of white parents were sitting in classrooms where more than 50% of the teachers didn't even have a minor degree in the courses they were teaching, they wouldn't be silent. If white Michael Browns were being gunned down in epidemic numbers by police officers across this country, whites would not be silent. If the average earning potential of a white laborer was $27,000 a year less than their black counterpart, they would not be silent. Whites don't speak because they don't have to. And one of the most interesting things to watch when Michael Brown gets shot in the streets of Ferguson is the public rhetoric afterwards of the white leaders and the black leaders. Where is the rage? What you hear from white leaders is a defense of the white police, not officer, but the white police force. Trying to contextualize how that, even if it wasn't the right thing to do, contextualize how that could have happened the way it did. And justify, rationalize, or explain the behavior. Whites don't speak and remain silent because they don't have to. Two, guilt. The enormous emotional cost that whites bear because of the guilt. It's exactly what produces the emotion that surfaces every time I talk about my father, right? Just below the surface is this powerful sense of guilt. And I've seen this 1,000 times. I know many of you have also. When you put blacks and whites in a room and you start talking about race, invariably, a white person will speak about their guilt and shame, get deeply emotional, and ask the black people in the room to either forgive them or help them understand and deal with this. The guilt is just below the surface. And whites don't want to face or confront the guilt and shame that is resident, which is why I always start with my story. Because the open telling of those stories produces a spiritual healing of a wound that has been left untended for centuries now. And our unwillingness to deal with that and We live in such denial about the psychological and spiritual impact that we carry. That wound is right there. And that's the second reason why white leaders remain silent in the face of white power, white privilege, and white supremacy. The third is the fear of black rage. The myth of the black man as savage beast is a part of the American landscape and has been since our founding days. There was a study, this is 10 years ago, it's probably not true today, but it makes the point. There was a study done of the Washington Post, a fairly liberal-leaning newspaper, and over 6 months, every portrayal in the Washington Post of a black male was either as the perpetrator of a crime or the victim of a crime. Now, A, you have to deliberately choose for 6 months not to show a black civic leader, black business representative or owner, and you are perpetuating the mythology of black rage. I can remember after the Rodney King verdict and the riots in Los Angeles and other parts of the country, preaching to my white church a sermon about the lion and the lamb lying together. And talking about, and I'll take a moment to unfold that metaphor here for us. The lion and the lamb is a beautiful vision, but you do understand that there are almost no circumstances under which the lion can lie with the lamb and actually feel comfort. So let's say they're there together, but the lion still has its teeth, its claws, its musculature, its size, its roar, its memory of itself as the king of the jungle. Under what circumstances is the lamb ever lying there in comfort and in peace? Right? Because at any moment, the lion could change its mind and the whole equation changes. So the only circumstance in which the lamb is actually there of its own will and actually feeling peaceful is if the lion has cut off its claws, cut out its teeth, found some way to disable its musculature, lost its voice, and its memory. Otherwise, and when we begin to talk about white power and white privilege, the power of the lion, I mean, at what point do people of color trust the white power as it says, you know, live with us in peace, when it hasn't given up its military might, it hasn't given up its control of the media, it hadn't given up its control to wealth and capital? At what point do you begin to say, oh, sure, we trust you? And I'm preaching that sermon, and that Rodney King, that LA had just erupted in riots, and I say, if, to a largely white audience, we're unwilling to dismantle this system of privilege that we have, the only alternative is for the lion and the lamb to lie together in a pool of blood. This fear of black rage so dismantles our willingness to let go of our privilege and power that even when the most egregious acts of racial injustice are perpetrated, we remain silent and live in utter fear that the rage is going to erupt at any minute, and we do everything we can to suppress it. And Ferguson is the perfect example last October of what this looks like. When a city council, about to announce that they were not going to indict Darren Wilson, and knowing that once the announcement was made, the city was going to erupt, waited till Friday night after dark, and then littered the street with riot police and tear gas. And they were ready to deal with whatever black rage erupted. But their fear of black rage affected every decision they made walking up to that, except the decision to do what they should have done in the first place, which is put Darren Wilson on trial for murder. They wouldn't go that far. And then the fourth reason, and I'm going to state this, and I'm going to read a letter, and then we'll have about 10 or 15 minutes for questions. The fourth reason that white people remain silent about white power, white privilege, and white supremacy is they don't want to have a conversation about reparations. They don't want to have a conversation about reparations. Randall Robinson has written a book called The Debt, in which he makes the case for reparations. It's one of the most cogent, well-researched, well-written pieces on the subject. And I highly recommend you read it. But there's a piece of literature that goes back even further than that, written by a former slave, Jordan Anderson. And if you give me 1 second, I'm going to pull that up here and read it for you. This is beautiful. So this is a letter from Jordan Anderson, Dayton, Ohio, August 7th. I just noticed that, Dayton, Ohio. That's where I did my doctoral work on white privilege. 1865, and it's addressed to my old master, Colonel P.H. Anderson of Big Spring, Tennessee. It's a little lengthy. It's not overly long, but I'm going to read the whole thing to you. Sir, I got your letter and was glad to find that you had not forgotten Jordan and that you wanted me to come back and live with you again, promising to do better for me than anybody else can. I have often felt uneasy about you. I thought the Yankees would have hung you long before this for harboring Rebs they found at your house. I suppose they never heard about your going to Colonel Martin's to kill the Union soldier that was left by his company in their stable. And although you shot at me twice before I left you, I did not want to hear of your being hurt, and I'm glad that you are still living. It would do me good to go back to the dear old home again and see Miss Mary and Miss Martha, Ellen, Esther, Green, and Lee. Give my love to them all and tell them I hope we will meet in the better world, if not in this. I would have gone back to see you all when I was working in the Nashville hospital, but one of the neighbors told me that Henry intended to shoot me if he ever got the chance. I want to know particularly what the good chance is you propose to give me. I am doing tolerably well here. I get $25 a month with victuals and clothing, have a comfortable home for Mandy, the folks call her Mrs. Anderson, and the children, Millie, Jane, and Grundy, go to school and are learning well. The teacher says Grundy has a head for a preacher. They go to Sunday school, and Mandy and me attend church regularly. We are kindly treated. Sometimes we overhear others saying, them colored people were slaves down in Tennessee. The children feel hurt when they hear such remarks. But I tell them it was no disgrace in Tennessee to belong to Colonel Anderson. Many darkies would have been proud, as I used to be, to call you master. Now, if you will write and say what wages you will give me, I will be better able to decide whether it would be to my advantage to move back again. As to my freedom, which you say I can have, there is nothing to be gained on that score, as I got my free papers in 1864 from the Provost Marshal General of the Department of Nashville. Mandy says she would be afraid to go back without some proof that you were disposed to treat us justly and kindly, and we have concluded to test your sincerity by asking you to send us our wages for the time we served you. This will make us forget and forgive old scores and rely on your justice and friendship in the future. I served you faithfully for 32 years, and Mandy 20 years. At $25 a month for me and $2 a week for Mandy, our earnings would amount to $11,680. Add this to the interest for the time our wages have been kept back. Deduct what you paid for our clothing and three doctor's visits to me and pulling a tooth for Mandy, and the balance will show what we are in justice entitled to. Please send the money by Adams Express in care of V. Winters, Esquire, Dayton, Ohio. If you fail to pay us for faithful labors in the past, we can have little faith in your promises in the future. Let me read that again. If you fail to pay us for faithful labors in the past, we can have little faith in your promises in the future. We trust the good Maker has opened your eyes to the wrongs which you and your fathers have done to me and my fathers in making us toil for you for generations without recompense. Here I draw my wages every Saturday night, but in Tennessee there was never any payday for the Negroes any more than for the horses and cows. Surely there will be a day of reckoning for those who defraud the laborer of his hire. In answering this letter, please state if there would be any safety for Millie and Jane, who are now grown up and both good-looking girls. You know how it was with poor Matilda and Catherine. I would rather stay here and starve and die if it came to that than have my girls brought to shame by the violence and wickedness of your young masters. You will also please state if there has been any schools open for the colored children in your neighborhood. The great desire of my life now is to give my children an education and have them form virtuous habits. Say howdy to George Carter and thank him for taking the pistol from you when you were shooting at me. From your old servant, Jordan Anderson. It's hard for whites to remember that the wealth that we inherit came from such a system. It's hard for us to remember that in these days, when as whites we're earning $27,000 a year more than our black laborers, that when we're living in houses whose relative value is two or three times greater than the middle class black families who live in their homes, that the roots of this inherited wealth go back to such a system. And it's so easy for whites to say, I didn't own slaves. And yet for generations, laborers were forced to work under the most horrific conditions and given nothing, no wealth to inherit or pass on from one generation to the next. And whites remain silent about this matter because if we ever were asked to even the score and level the playing field, the wealth that we would be giving up, we believe to be greater than the price for justice. And we remain silent. I've got about 10 minutes. That's a quick introduction to some of the pieces of white privilege studies, a part of our ongoing commitments to sacred conversations on race. And we're going to pause here to see what comments, thoughts, or questions you might have. Hi, Dolores.
Hi, Dan. I want to thank you for that powerful construct of white privilege, and quickly I'd like to admit that because I was married to a theologian for 52 years, I had the pleasure of meeting James Cone, and I have an autographed copy of Black Liberation Theology. I also have my African Heritage Study Bible, which was edited by the Reverend Dr. Kane Hope Felder of the Howard University Divinity School, who was my husband's colleague before he went into the pastorate. Now here's what, quickly, biblical reference. Study to show thyself approved, a servant who need not be ashamed. That is from 2 Timothy. I feel that the basis, and at 86, it isn't arrogance, it's belief and study. I feel that the most credible source of the mess that we are living in, and I reference it that way because I'm holding in my hand right now from the London Guardian an article titled Neoliberalism, the Ideology at the Root of All of Our Problems. And that was just published this April 15, 2016. Now, having said that, you used some powerful words. You used taught. You took me back to my high school biology class, in which I learned that there are two phylum orders, animal and plant. Man is at the top. Ashley Montague says that race is a pseudoscience. We are human beings. We adapt it to the environment, and that's why we see the superficial differences when we look at one another. It was advantageous to divide us because it waters down the power. If we are going to reference ourselves by race instead of human beings, then people of color would be the majority, and white people would be the minority. And that also is a part of the fear. I'm a victim of revisionist history, but I studied for 20 years under outstanding scholars in the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilizations, when Europeans went down to Egypt to study with the teachers in the mystery school there. They took it back to Europe and stole it and fed it back to us. One of the, and I apologize, but I will be gone soon at 86. Another credible author, George G.M. James, wrote the book Stolen Legacy. So when I speak, it isn't from my limited wisdom, but as I said, I am also a student. I also hold in my hand what I took from Google, titled A List of African American Inventors and Scientists. And it's 17 pages that average about 20 each of inventions and scientific contributions we've made to this country. I superimposed over the title, Black Inventions, Backbone of American Capitalism. When will you pay us the debt that you owe, or even recognize that we have the intellectual genius in the spite of the horrific situation that we've lived under to contribute inventions and scientific breakthroughs? How do you know being the one country on the planet that has more people incarcerated than in any other, that you have within those walls someone who has the cure for cancer and other things. Thank you.
Thank you.
I was interested in your information about St. Louis. Do you have any conclusion as to why racism is still so rampant in St. Louis? Is it compared to other major metropolitan areas, is it greater or lesser, do you think?
It's definitely one of the worst, and I honestly don't know the reason why. I do know that about 10 years ago, 60 Minutes did an expose on race, and especially on privilege, in which they took a white man and a black man, same age, same educational background, same income level, and put them on the streets of St. Louis and followed them with a camera. Grocery store, bank, car lot, hailing a taxi, and in every setting, walk onto the car lot. When the white guy walked in, the cameras were showing the sales team. They were fighting each other to get to the door to be, right, put the black man on the lot. They show the sales team inside. Nobody moves. I mean, for 10 minutes, nobody's moved. Taxi cab, time after time after time, taxi passes the white guy holds his hand up. You see the taxi squealing its brakes and stopping. I don't know the answer why. I just know that it is one of the most racially divided cities in America. I wish I knew more, but I don't. Hi, Wilma.
Hi. I've lived 67 years of a life of forced less than.
Yep.
No matter what I've tried to do, it hasn't worked like a lot of other people. 5 straight years of talks, conferences, workshops about the evils and the consequences of forced poverty and racism on my community and the Native American community. And we very seldom even discuss Native Americans anymore. It's like we've wiped them out and we don't have to bother. But I want to know, when do the leaders of the faith community publicly stand together and demand that the stealing from our communities be stopped, be repaid, and given back reparations, that it be given back to the rightful owners so that we can really mean, when we say Black Lives Matter, we can really mean that they really matter. We can say Black Lives Matter all we want, but when you know a foot is on that neck, does it really matter? No. And I just see it as hypocritical that in our churches, we're taught, thou shall not steal, thou shall not make profit from stolen goods. But it's okay that America has stolen and gotten away with it, and people are prospering big time. So my thing is, the financial playing field must be made level, and the justice system has got to be made level before people can come together. Because a lot of times people tell me I'm standoffish about going into groups where there are whites and come have dinner with us, and we can come to your community and you can come to mine. But why are there two separate communities?
Right.
And until I can freely, on an equal playing field, go into a community,
right.
I'm not interested until mine is brought up.
Thank you. So, yeah. A couple months ago, I was doing this presentation in Hillsborough, New Hampshire, and somebody asked the question, you know, now that we've elected a black president and now X, Y, or Z, do you think that things are going to change? And I said, as long as the 1% are 97% white and control 90% of the capital wealth, nothing is going to change. Elect all the black presidents you want. Until the wealth is redistributed, nothing changes. And you know as well as I do those white men with that wealth are not giving it up easily. Yeah.
Well, just as you answer the question, what do you see? Well, how often do you feel overwhelmed? And what do you do when you feel overwhelmed?
Oh. So there are two answers to that question. One is, I feel overwhelmed every day, right? But the second answer, which is probably the more honest answer, is, so what? I mean, I'm white. How bad is it going to get for me? And when we talk about being overwhelmed, I mean, we're talking about a slice of the injustice pie here when we're talking about white privilege. We could be talking about climate change. I feel utterly overwhelmed. We could be talking about immigration politics, and I feel utterly overwhelmed. But at the end of the day, I don't live in the world Wilma does. And being overwhelmed as a white man, I'm not asking for anybody's sympathy. Wilma is forced to work in a world with a foot on her neck, as she says, I'll never walk in that world. So, being overwhelmed. We'll do maybe one more and then we'll do our break.
UCC published a really wonderful curriculum on human sexuality about 20 or 30 years ago. I don't know how long ago it was. When are we going to have the same sort of thing on race?
I'm glad you asked. Put September on your calendar. We're a week away from the last raw material being submitted by five authors who are putting the curriculum together for the United Church of Christ to engage in system-wide, safe, meaningful, substantive, and courageous conversations, not on race, but on privilege. And on Sunday, May 1st, that's the deadline for the last materials from the five authors to be into our publishing house. The first three sections are already in and are being edited and formatted. We've got a series of settings throughout the life of the church that are going to pilot that material and read it and review it and give us feedback. We'll do another edit. We're going to do some promotion through the summer months, including a series of webinars that the Center for Progressive Renewal are going to host the week of June 20th. On July 1st, we'll open up registration to purchase the materials, and they'll be delivered to churches for use in September. Good question. Thank you.